ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 23rd of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The political ramifications of the coalition's divorce are still unfolding. The futures of both the Liberal and National Party's leaders and the union itself are uncertain. It's the second split in less than a year, with some suggesting the saga ultimately helps One Nation. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this story.
David Gazzard started his first job in politics days after the 1996 Port Arthur massacre, working as a media advisor for Prime Minister John Howard. He saw firsthand how difficult it was for the coalition to deliver gun control reforms.
At the time, they were enormously controversial and put massive pressure on the National Party, which was then led by Tim Fischer, who, to his credit, stood up to pressure in the bush mainly.
The decades-old partnership between the Liberals and Nationals has been tested in the past, and tensions have forced the parties apart before. But David Gazzard says this week's breakup is unprecedented.
In the coalition going back decades, I can't recall a time where the leader of one party has effectively spelled out the leadership of the other coalition partner. In this case, David Littleproud has basically said, we're not going to be in the coalition with the Liberal Party if Susan Lee remains the leader.
The National Party severed its alliance with the Liberals yesterday after opposition leader Susan Lee accepted the resignations of three Nationals frontbenchers who broke the rules of shadow cabinet in voting against hate speech laws. It's left both parties' leaders in a precarious position and reignited speculation of a Liberal leadership spill. Christy McSweeney is a former coalition advisor.
I think Susan Lee's days as leader of the opposition are numbered. It is a tragedy that she happens to be in the chair when the Liberal Party is coming to a fight or an ideological consensus or non-consensus around issues that have been buried for a very, very long time.
The fallout has also prompted speculation that more Nationals MPs could defect to Pauline Hanson's One Nation party, similar to Barnaby Joyce. The One Nation recruit has confirmed he's had conversations with some MPs about them joining the minor party, which has seen a bump in support in recent polling. But he's downplayed the seriousness of the talks. The federal president of the National Party, Andrew Fraser, says he's not threatened.
Barnaby Joyce and Pauline Hanson are making big noises, but the reality is our membership since Barnaby's jump ship has increased in that area. I think we lost five members out of a huge membership in the Tamworth area or New England.
Associate Professor in Politics at Monash University, Zare Gazarian, says he doesn't expect One Nation to be a significant player in the lower house.
But what One Nation can do and is doing at the moment is providing an option for those who may be dissatisfied with the coalition and allowing them to essentially voice their concern by supporting One Nation, at least in published opinion polls. Now, whether that translates, of course, to how people vote on election day in a couple of years' time, that's the big question that remains to be seen.
Opposition leader Susan Lee didn't do media interviews yesterday, saying the focus must be on the National Day of Mourning for the Bondi terror attack.
Political reporter Romy Stevens there, and coming up after 7:30 on Radio National Breakfast, Sally Sara speaks to Liberal Senator Anne Rushton. There are still several people missing after a landslide hit a holiday park in New Zealand. Searches continued through the night at Mount Maunganui, south of Auckland. Another two people were found dead in a second landslide at nearby Welcome Bay. Our correspondent Kathleen Calderwood joined me earlier from the recovery site.
Well, Isabella, sadly, there's been no news overnight here in Mount Maunganui. I'm actually sitting looking at the site of this landslide. There's just a huge amount of debris and soil that's been moved in this landslide. Of course, yesterday morning, there was this huge landslip which hit a holiday park here in Mount Maunganui, which is one of New Zealand's most popular holiday destinations. It hit several caravans caravans and a sort of a toilet block at this holiday park. So that's really where most of the work is going on now. They have been working throughout the night. I could hear the excavators going all night long, and just observing it this morning, it seems to me like they're sort of, you know, doing the heavy work of digging a lot of that debris away. And then when they think they might be getting close perhaps, or they might hear something perhaps, they seem to be slowing down and I guess working as with as much finesse as you can with an excavator. There's quite a few locals actually sitting around watching, but it's certainly a very sad and somber mood here in Mount Maunganui at the moment.
And Kathleen, have authorities said anything about the complexity of this rescue operation or the next phase it might move into?
Yeah, they're still calling it a rescue operation, although just going off local media reporting, there hasn't been anything heard from inside underneath this debris for some time since yesterday. But they are still saying it's a rescue operation. Of course, they are dealing with the possibility of further landslips as well. That's something that's really on the mind of the emergency services here. And the area is cordoned off, so there's no sort of cars, you know, local cars or anything like that allowed down the street. But the Emergency Management and Recovery Minister, Mark Mitchell, has been speaking to Radio New Zealand earlier today, and he said that they've been waiting with the families all night. And as you can imagine, it's been a really nervous and sad wait.
It is an awful situation that they're in. It's a very somber mood there, very emotional. And you could imagine when you've got your loved one stuck in a slip like that and you're waiting, it's pretty torturous for them. And so we're really focused, everyone's focused on supporting them and trying to shoulder as much of that weight as we can.
That's New Zealand's Emergency Management and Recovery Minister, Mark Mitchell. And before that, our correspondent, Kathleen Calderwood, on the ground. You're listening to AM, where it's 16 minutes past 7. The Ukrainian president says negotiations to end the war in his country are in the final mile. Volodymyr Zelensky met with US President Donald Trump for talks on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. He praised his US counterpart but had harsh words for other allies, accusing Europe of talking tough but avoiding action. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer has more.
President Zelensky! Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he wouldn't be going to the World Economic Forum in Davos, but something changed his mind. When he arrived on centre stage in front of world leaders and global elites, everyone soon learned why Ukraine's leader was now eager to speak.
Everyone remembers the great American film Groundhog Day with Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. No one would want to live like that. Repeating the same thing for weeks, months, and of course for years. And it's our life. And every forum like this one proves it.
Mr. Zelensky had made the long journey from Kyiv to criticise the endless talk fest at these summits that's yet to deliver anything consequential for war-torn Ukraine.
Europe loves to discuss the future, but avoids taking action today. Action that defines what kind of future we will have.
In one of his most fiery speeches since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Mr. Zelensky expressed frustration over his allies' unwillingness to pursue Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
President Trump led an operation in Venezuela and Maduro was arrested. Maduro is on trial in New York. Sorry, but Putin is not on trial.
Mr. Zelensky's other reason for visiting Davos was to speak with US President Donald Trump in a sidelines bilateral. This was the commander-in-chief as he prepared to meet his Ukrainian counterpart.
I think they're getting close. A lot of people are being killed. We got to get it done. If we don't get that done, it would be...
Mr. Trump then made the often repeated claim that Mr. Putin and Mr. Zelensky were close to a deal, and his go-to negotiator, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, was also hinting that something could soon be settled.
And I think we've got it down to one issue, and we have discussed iterations of that issue, and that means it's solvable.
That one sticking point is territory. The Kremlin is unwilling to budge from its demand that Ukraine surrender the Donbass as part of any peace deal. Delegates from Kyiv, Moscow and Washington will meet for negotiations in the UAE over the weekend. Mr. Zelensky will travel back to Kyiv, a country facing regular power outages in the brutal cold and relentless Russian airstrikes. The Groundhog Day continues. This is Elias Glower in London, reporting for AM.
Syrian government forces have pushed into the northeast of the country this week, putting a focus on the future of Kurdish-controlled areas. Violence between the Syrian military and Kurdish fighters has erupted following a failed deal about management of the territory. Analysts say the United States publicly shifting its support has escalated the situation. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Naim Square in central Raqqa, residents mark what they describe as the liberation of their city. This place used to be referred to as the Roundabout of Hell, when Islamic State occupied the city as its capital and used the square for public executions. This week, it's a space for celebration, according to 38-year-old local Lamia Hayek.
We are no longer afraid. Today we went out with our children to see them, to rejoice with them, to be happy, because we've waited a lifetime for this moment.
Since 2017, Raqqa has been controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, a coalition of Kurdish militia which had been backed by the United States in the war against Islamic State. In the last week, the SDF has been forced to withdraw as Syrian government forces swept through. The scars of fighting are clear to see, with bodies of those caught in the crossfire lying crumpled alongside them. Locals in this Arab town are happy to now see the back of the Kurdish forces, among them 50-year-old Mohammed El-Dagir.
During this period, they followed the same approach as the fallen regime in Raqqa, deteriorating services, theft, looting and the spread of drugs in the city.
When Ahmed al-Sharr led his rebel Islamist militia to the Syrian capital, Damascus, toppling the regime of dictator Bashar al-Assad in late 2024, it wasn't the end of the fight for Syria's future. The Kurds controlled around a quarter of Syria, well beyond the Kurds' traditional territory, governing it as an autonomous region backed in by their own militia. The new president, al-Sharr, made no secret of wanting to unite the country and had proposed a plan to integrate the Kurdish territory into the state. But a deal between the two sides in March 2025 stalled, with the Kurds not wanting to give up their autonomy.
If you want to think about it as a race, and they felt that they deserved a silver medal.
Sami Akil is a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy.
However, at the same time, the Syrian government was like, we are the ones who toppled the regime that started this whole mess, and we are the central government now, and security arrangements have to go through us.
The pivotal moment, according to Dr. Jonathan Speyer from the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, was when the United States publicly shifted its support from the Kurds to the government forces, saying the SDF's primary role in combating Islamic State, securing the prisons where their fighters are housed and the camps where their families lived, including a number of Australian women and children, was over.
There's no reason anymore, in their view, to maintain this relationship, which in their view had outlived its purpose with the SDF. And therefore, once their guarantees to the SDF were withdrawn, then Sharia was free to act, and act he has in a very determined way.
Pushing the Kurds out of their unique situation is fueling fears in their community that they'll be targeted by forces loyal to Ahmed al-Sharr. The Kurds have been given a deadline of the weekend to hand over control of their last provinces in the northeast. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Earlier this month, an intense heatwave saw temperatures soar above 40 degrees across parts of southeastern Australia. The heat brought with it devastating bushfires. Now, new analysis has found climate change made this extreme weather five times more likely. Isabel Misali reports.
Cardiologist and physician Dr. Anna Greta Hunter returned to her work in Canberra 2 weeks ago, just as a severe heatwave began to take hold.
We'd be at 30 degrees by 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And so for my older and more infirm or more unwell patients, they're walking perhaps only for a few minutes, but sometimes a bit longer, between a parked car and the office. And I'm aware that that's going to potentially impact on their health.
But she also had concerns for the general public. She's the chair of the ACT Climate Change Council.
We've known this in the Australian context for quite a while, that heat waves drive hospital admissions across the sector. I have no doubt if they analyse that data from that period, there will be an increase in hospital admissions with things like heart attack and stroke and arrhythmia.
Heat waves kill more Australians than bushfires, cyclones and floods. and they're becoming more frequent. Professor Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick is a climate scientist at the Australian National University.
We know that we've always had heat waves, but heat waves are an extreme event, and by that it means that they should be very rare. But as global temperature increases, regional temperature will increase, and with that comes a much higher frequency and intensity of heat waves.
In that second week of January, temperatures pushed past 40 degrees in large parts of southeastern Australia, and devastating bushfires soon spread across Victoria. So did climate change play a role? Professor Perkins Kirkpatrick worked with an international science group to determine just that. It's called world weather attribution.
So we look at things like what climate variable do we measure the event by, what sort of size did the event take up, and how long did it last for? And then basically they have this framework that is already set up and ready to go once they feed in that information. So it will be a range of climate models and a range of observations that are used in conjunction to tell us about whether or not climate change had a role behind this particular event, and if it did, how strong was that role?
The analysis has found human-caused climate change made this heatwave five times more likely. It was the most severe heatwave for this region in 6 years. Climate change made it hotter, adding an average 1.6 degrees to the temperature. And the scientists warn if carbon emissions continue on its predicted trajectory, then heatwaves like this one can be expected every 2 years by the end of the century.
So if you think about an event like this occurring once every 2 years, like that does put stress on our bodies and our infrastructure and our ecosystems. But it makes you also think about the worst events that will occur more often as well. Maybe not once every 2 years, but once every 4 or once every 5 years. And the damage that they will do to our system.
The scientists are calling for emissions to be urgently cut, and for Australians to better prepare for the dangers of extreme heat.
That report by Isabel Misali and Tyne Logan. Aged care experts are calling for more teenagers to work in the sector. Projections show an extra 35,000 workers are needed each year, and a migrant workforce can't cover the shortfall. At one facility, teens are already lifting staffing and spirits. National Work reporter Bronwyn Herbert.
On the New South Wales Central Coast, a nursing home's common room is transformed into a makeshift day spa. Three teenagers are at work, filling plastic tubs with warm water, gently pressing eye masks onto weary faces. They dim the lights and start foot massages and facials.
Yeah. Oh, I'm good to her.
Died and gone to heaven.
18-year-old Kaylin O'Keefe started at the Uniting facility as part of school work experience and then landed a permanent job leading leisure activities.
Most of my friends, when I tell them about my job, they had no idea that it was even an option. It's such a good thing to go into, especially being such a young age and having a sort of big girl job.
After volunteering, teens China Ambler and Liam O'Brien joined the team too.
I didn't expect to love it as much as I do now. Like, I couldn't ever imagine doing anything else.
Well, I was working at McDonald's and then I went to work at a pub for a little bit, so very different scenery from aged care. I was volunteering for about a month and then I got a job opportunity and I've been here for about 2 years now.
There are almost 500,000 people working in aged care right now, but new care requirements coming out of the Royal Commission and introduced last year mean more staff are needed. Tracy Burton is the Chief Executive of Uniting New South Wales and ACT.
We know that some of the forecasts are to almost double the workforce that we need by 2050, so an additional 400,000 people to come into the aged care sector.
Irene Blackberry is the Director of the Care Economy Research Institute based out of La Trobe University and wants high school students considered as part of the workforce mix.
Tapping into the younger generation is an area that, you know, we ought to consider. A lot of the young people, you know, like 14, 15 and over at the moment, they can actually work in the hospitality industry. And I don't see any reason why, really, you know, we can't actually explore the potential, if you like.
Isn't she lovely?
Back on the Central Coast, coordinator Bronwyn Corley couldn't be more pleased with the young team members.
Up to about 40% of our residents don't have regular visitors. That can be as simple as family lives a long way away, or some of them don't have anyone left. So having our young people come in and work in the facility, they become almost like grandchildren to them.
And it's clear the workers are bringing the fun factor.
We love them.
They're so lovely and they just mix in with it so well.
Aged care resident Maureen Moorcroft ending Bronwyn Herbert's report. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For a second time since the election, the coalition has split. So, is this a moment of real change in politics? And could it help the rise of One Nation? Today, the ABC's national political lead, David Spears, on how the marriage fell apart once again. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.